So what if you can't touch the sky? It doesn't mean you shouldn't try. Do you wanna fly?
All good things come to an end. This is no exception. The final episode of the High Time series. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for joining in on every other episode, but only if you did. If you didn't, then fuck you. this final episode, we sat down with Justin Malotnikov. He directed a few episodes of High Times, as well as a lot of other stuff you might be familiar with, all the way from Taggart to Poldark to My Parents Are Aliens, which is one of my co-host's favourites, isn't it?
Aye, I loved it. I grew up watching that. So we do kind of talk to him a little bit about that and other stuff that he's done, because these actors, these directors, writers that we've been speaking to for the last 12 weeks, these guys, you know, major talents. They've worked on so many things that all of us know and love. So it'd be silly to just kind of brush over it. So we kind of try and brush over it a wee bit and kind of stick to High Times.
What I noticed, like, a couple of times during the conversation, he brings it back to High Times. That's when I realised I was fucking up a wee bit.
you can't have these people on your podcast and not talk about some of the other great work that they've done.
No.
Stupid. It'd be stupid.
Absolutely not. I mean, to get the opportunity to speak to people that are in an industry that I've been too much of a shite bag to try and get into for the last 30 years, you can't pass up You can't pass up the opportunity.
True that. So it's a bittersweet day today, guys. You are tuning in for the final episode of the High Times miniseries. But just remember, we have plans in the future, after lockdown, to reunite all these guys that you've been listening to on the show. Come and see them in person when we get that ball moving. We're going to create such a fan experience for everybody that loved that show to come along, and you guys can speak to them, buy merchandise, and we can all just love High Times, and who knows where it'll go from there. So, you know, there's many positives to be taken away from what we've done over the last 12 weeks. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to all of them, and for them to even given us the time of day. We can't thank Stephen McCall enough for kind of putting this together for us. It's something that I will always hold as a highlight of my podcasting career, however short it may have been so far, 2 years in. But this for us is probably one of the greatest things we've ever done, and it's just been an absolute joy. What about yourself, J-Mac?
Just that sentiment again. Stephen was nice enough to kind of put his time into making sure that everybody else was okay with it and giving us phone numbers and stuff to actually get in contact with him. So, no, a massive thanks to him, and massive prop cheese to that boy.
And to everybody else, every other guest that's come on, you know, just everybody got so much love for High Times, and we've got so much love for them, and they're just lovely bloody people. Go back and check out every single episode of the High Times series, because it's been a hell of a ride, and it's been great to hear the different sides of stories. It's been great to hear stories behind the scenes, and just how some of these relationships have blossomed into, you know, like strong friendships over the last 15 years. If you haven't watched High Times, the fuck you doing, mate? Get back and fucking watch it, mate. Go back and watch it. You can find it on the STV player. I don't even know where that's from. But go back and watch it on the STV player. You can find it there. Or you can go and check it out on YouTube. Just remember, I don't think either of them get paid, regardless where you watch it. So just watch it. Appreciate it. And come to us and tell us what you thought about it. And then help us crowdfund bringing it back in the future. All right?
Yeah, because we're going to do that.
I mean, we're just going to get the money and give it to them and let them do as they please to make the show. Like, that's the goal.
That's the plan. I can see it happening. Maybe not in the near future, but it's going to fucking happen.
Oh, it'll happen. If it doesn't happen, then fucking prop cheese to that.
Prop cheese off.
Exactly. So we're joined today by Justin.
So let's time to kick back, relax, and listen to Justin Malotnikov. Justin Malotnikov, how are you doing?
I'm very good, thanks. Delighted to be on this podcast with you guys.
So am I. no, it's great to have you on. Thanks for giving us some of your time. I know you're a busy, busy man.
Mm-hmm. Do that.
Just moving on. so the main reason you're here is because basically you directed a few episodes of High Times. This is the finale, by the way. You're in the last episode of the series. We saved the best for last. Wink, wink. And then
the last one the private detective could find. I've been lying low for a long time since I've done this show.
We'll talk about that. So obviously, the High Times isn't your only thing. Obviously, you've got a lot behind you. I've been kind of looking into your work history, and it's for want of a better expression, it's fucking impressive.
My parents say it was my favourite as a kid. Loved it.
Was it really?
Oh, hi, man.
It's amazing how many people bring that one up. Oh, I mean, it was so a joy good. To work on, but it was one of my first gigs in TV, and it's where actually I met Davey Mackay, director. Well, one of the other directors, but that was a lot of fun to work on, and in a way, I actually knocked that job back initially because I was a filmmaker, and I was trying to sort of make short films, not realizing that this was a really well sort of put together show. It misfired a wee bit to start with, but Davey and I just sort of ran with that. Producer Bernard Kuchewski, I think he worked at STV or SMG for a while as well. But that was a lot of fun to work on, and it really sort of helped me think about comedy as a form. I hadn't really, I'd sort of tried to write bits of humour into my short film scripts, but that was very technical.
That was a staple point in my after school schedule.
Yeah, brilliant. Should we just talk about that?
We'll do the next series, right?
No, because I've not seen it. I missed the boat on that one. I was a wee bit. I'm a bit older than Kevin, so it wasn't part of my daily viewing.
I just want to point out what I was actually Santa Claus in the Christmas episode. That's of right. Babies. I never got paid for it. I just did it because Davey was my mate, and I just put the funds into the rap party afterwards. Little did I know that I was going to be on every fucking Christmas for the next 15 years with no repeat fees.
this industry.
I mean, I've seen you've done an episode of Taggart. You've done, moving past that, you pulled Ark very recently. That show obviously went down like an absolute storm.
It did. It was a massive show to do in some respects. And it was a crazy show to do. I was on that for nearly a year, actually. Just partly the way they shoot it. You could be, quite unusual in a way, but you could be directing in the morning and then stood down while the other director does some scenes in the afternoon, so it's very mixed up as a production. But by the time I'd come on episode series 5, I think it was, it's a well-oiled machine, and it's very production led by that point. Mm-hmm. They know what they're doing, or they should. Spend some time in Cornwall and work with Ross Poldark and the team.
Again, unfortunately, I haven't seen it yet.
I'm not going to post.
I know. Have you watched High Times, Jordan?
I'm just gone. Right, I'll see you later. What I did see was Crying with Laughter, but we'll talk about that later on. That's something else.
I mean, I should say Taggart was a great break for me, and as well, in as much as it's difficult. Getting going in this industry, everyone wants people who are experienced, and if you haven't got the experience, you don't get the gig. So you're sort of waiting for that opportunity where maybe they're looking for slightly cheaper directors or there's a gap come up and you're kicking about at the right time. But I think one of the key reasons I got Taggart was because at High Times, I am trying to talk about High Times in a way. And that's, Eric Coulter, I think with High Times, from the top to the bottom, there was a lot of talent on that show, even though it was a minuscule budget. And Eric Coulter, much more an old school producer in a way, very director-led, and Taggart was like that. I worked with him for the first time on High Times, and I remember him rolling about the edit suite laughing and stuff like that. And, you could really see that he was enjoying what we were doing. I think that was probably a door into Taggart. I'm not sure I would have got it otherwise,
Yeah, I mean, another legendary show in itself,
You've seen that, right?
I've actually seen a lot of that, so I'm quite proud of myself at this point.
He's seen the advert for it. He saw the trailer. He just watched his trailer.
Oh, no, I know the theme tune, man. That's it.
Go on, then. Sing it.
That's it. That's all you're getting. I'm too talented for that nonsense. So, hi Times. How did you first get involved with it anyway?
I mean, to give it a context, I suppose. I mean, I'd worked with Davey Mackay and My Parents Are Aliens. Then I went and developed a show for BBC called Shoebox Zoo, sort of children's fantasy. It was one of the early sort of CGI live-action fantasy shows. And I went into the BBC partly because My Parents Are Aliens, they were looking for some sort of higher-end drama to come out of children's. And I mean, I wasn't that experienced, you know, but at the same time, you know, I was just done a huge show that was doing incredibly well, you know. And Scotland's always sort of, sometimes it's got talent there, sometimes it hasn't. And it's what I'm saying before, you know, you sit there and you look about and what opportunities are there. And I got asked to come at the BBC, develop the drama. I thought, well, I'm not a development exec. I'm not really a script editor. I'm a director. So if I do get something commissioned, I want to direct it, you know, or have the choice of directing it, just put me back on that track. And I did that. That was a 3.5-year gig, developing it and then shooting it. And I cast Davey Mackay in it as McTaggart. So he was in all 26 episodes. So we weren't expecting what we got. I mean, it was a multi-million pound show, co-production shot in Scotland and Canada. So I just finished shooting the Canadian part of it. James Henry, the other director, worked on the first series of it, actually. We brought him in as one of the directors for half the eps. And so I met James there. I was obviously working with Davey. We were working in Canada with, you know, as much room as you ever want, huge sets, big crews, big open expanses, massive cast. You know, Peter Mullen was in it, some great Scottish actors, Alan Cumming, it was Siobhan Redmond. It was brilliant. And I did that for 3.5 years, and I came back and my contract was over and I didn't have a job and I was getting booted out of the BBC because I was never going to be a staffer. It's not what I was looking for anyway. And the final week I was there, I was playing rugby and I dislocated my ankle and broke my leg in 3 places. So I was pretty fucked, to be honest with you, going back into the, I didn't have a job and I sat there in the summer sort of hobbling about everywhere. And it was Carolyn Sinclair contacted me and said, would you have a meeting about this? I think Davey phoned me and said, look, are you interested in this? And I went, hi, you're not joking, you know. it's a real chance to sort of do something a bit different, you know. And I think that was what brought me in there. And I think, you know, I look back and I see, you know, there was Carolyn Sinclair Kidd who was producing it, who worked with Stephen on The Acid House, which I'd love. Grant and Star Cause was always one of my favourite stories in the book. And when they brought it to life and they were faithful to, you know, you take your hat off. And Stephen, even playing an Edinburgh boy, pulled it off, you know.
Oh, that must have felt like sacrilege to him, eh?
But it was great. And I was just thinking, bloody hell, there's some talent. I looked at the cast and there's some talent in this. And I hadn't seen the first series at that point, you know. I had to go and watch it. And I know Davey and James had directed it. But I had seen Blackout because I was on, sort of around on that scene at that time. And I remember Blackout has been a great wee short. So I didn't know John. I didn't know Stephen. But I made all the connections, and that was it, really. That was my end. I was hungry for it, and I'd done some decent stuff, although not a huge amount. And it was the next step stone for me. But to go from, I suppose, multi-million pounds, high, huge sets, big American outdoors, to condemned block of flats in Dalmarnock. I mean, the only thing that fitted in was me on crutches hobbling about. You know? That was, at the time, that was the thing. But it was great. It's what I needed. And in many respects, you never know if you're ever going to work in this game after we finished a gig. You just don't know what's going to come up. And for High Times to come up was exactly what I needed mentally, creatively, and you know, just to function, you know, just to get another job, a freelance job again after being at the BBC for 3.5 years.
Yeah. So, and I imagine after watching the first series, you were like, fucking yes, this is...
Yeah.
This is definitely my thing.
Did you think maybe the show... Because if you come on after watching the first series, did you think maybe to yourself, this has legs to go further than what it actually did?
Definitely. But not in an arrogant way. Just purely in a stylistic way for me. And it wasn't about it being better for me. It was about, I think, shooting it slightly differently. And you know, because it's a second series, you get the chance to play in a slightly different way as well. I wasn't, you know, I didn't have ties to the first one in that sense. Mm-hmm. But I really wanted to be there and make the audience feel they were in on it and part of it rather than looking mm-hmm. in on it. I think that's what I wanted to bring to it, a sort of a slightly freer energy with the camera that was more, I suppose it was more of a slave to the characters, because I saw it very much as such a character-driven show. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about trying to be too clever with the camera. It was about trying to find a relationship between the camera and the characters where the characters led it, you know? Mm-hmm.
Was it
that
yourself?
Was my approach.
I think Stephen had said that it was you that in the party scene at the end of the second season, like you do that all with just one moving camera.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. It's almost like you're sort of walking in with them.
Yeah.
I mean, that was an amazing scene, that. But not least because, I don't know if Stephen told you, probably went through it. That was our final day. It was all going to be shot in a day. We were going to have a rap party in the party scene afterwards. And it was all sort of, you know, it was going to be tight to do it. And I was bringing mates through from Edinburgh, old schoolmates, who were going to be in it as SAs as well, you know. Mm-hmm. And we got onto the MA and we hit the M74 and there was just this massive tailback and a lorry load full of, I think, pig fat or fat turned over on the motorway. And I'm like, I've got the biggest fucking scene ever to do here. And so... The guy who was, he was Canadian, my first AD who I'd worked with in Canada, I'd brought him over to Scotland. He was cursing me. He said, "Well, you brought me to, you know?" And I said to him, I says, "We're going to have to do this in the photo." I basically sat in my car on the motorway in front of a load of pig fat, directing him to set up the scene. And so that when I walked in, I could just walk in and almost go action. And everyone would have something to show me in terms of what they've done, you know? And so it was a real... I suppose, purely by circumstance, a great example of group intelligence.
That should
you know,
be
because
that should be on your CV. Anytime you go in for a job now, you should be like, "Well, I know you've directed stuff before, but have you directed while sitting in front of a big fucking overton truck with pig fat?" "No, you have no. I'll take the job, thanks." I mean, it's like, give us an example. Give us an example of the time you worked under pressure. Well, do you know what I mean?
Let me tell you.
For sure. If that doesn't get you the job, fuck. The job's not worth it.
I can just see it. Yeah. You get the phone call saying, listen, Justin, there's a massive pile up on the M8, so we're going to send you a chopper. You're like, "Don't need it, mate."
Throw that into the rat party. Throw the budget into the rat party.
I do think that's testament to how everyone felt about the show and how we were working. I mean, it wasn't... I mean, I walked into one big family. I wouldn't say it was a harmonious family, but there was a real sense immediately that we're all in this together. Mm-hmm. We're having fun and people are responding to it, and how do we keep that going? I mean, I was very lucky coming in at the time I did, in a sense, you know, as a director. It's quite hard to fit in sometimes, and you know, I've felt like an outsider through a whole shoot sometimes, you know, when you're fitting in. But I never done that. It was a real connection I had with a lot of the characters in there, you know. And I think partly my when I was at as a director at the time, I was starting to get really interested in body language, and this was perfect for it because I wanted to be character-led, so I could start thinking about, I could almost improvise in the moment with them myself. I was starting, you know, and we had that sort of almost guerrilla style ability to move about quickly because of the resources we never had, in a sense, you know. Yeah. So it made it really interesting to shoot. It made it a real sort of a show that was really driven by the energy of the moment rather than being too pre-planned.
Mm-hmm. That's something I was going to mention, actually. One thing we spoke to David Mackay about last week, that was an absolute laugh, by the way. He was some boy.
I've not seen him for a while, but no, he's cracking.
You should listen to that episode, man. It was good fun. but he was talking
about...
It's
my turn to say I haven't listened to the episode.
So he mentioned that there was a few kind of situations where he added wee bits in that weren't in the script and that, and there was a wee bit of kind of friction between him and John Rooney for a while. Was that something that you ever did or felt the need to do, or did you just kind of do what was on the page with your own kind of style?
No, I did it as I needed to. I mean, I try to be, you know, I write as well myself. You know, I appreciate where John's coming from. I mean, John's a wonderful writer. You know, I always, and this is the battle that you sort of have, I suppose, in the system, is for me, you know, a script is a leaping off point, a starting point in many respects, not just for me, but for the actors as well. And again, it's, you know, it wasn't their first scene. It was the last, I was doing the last three episodes and I wasn't as experienced as Davey in, say, the improvised form at that time. I've done a lot since, but you know, I could see what Davey was doing a bit, and you know, you're always keen to try things out yourself. You know, there was a lot for me to learn, and you know, once I started seeing how strong the actors were in their characters, it wasn't a question of what John had put down at times was crap. It never was crap in a way, but it could always be looked at and made to be better in a way. And you know, again, the talent, you know, you had Mike Ellen script edit, and Mike Ellen, talented guy as well. I mean, you had all these people very early on in their careers who you know, had, you know, it was a show by instinct in many respects. But you know, let's not forget the scripts were written up front and very unusually, you know, in the industry, and John wasn't hugely experienced to sell at the time. They were there when you were sitting down to prep. Yeah. A lot of the time you don't get that. So there was a great foundation there already, you know. And I always felt, the moment I walked in, I felt, you know, it felt like it knew what it was doing, even though there was things to find in it. So I maybe didn't leap as far as Davey did at that time. But yeah. But I definitely played with it a bit. And certainly with Stephen, I mean, you know, how can you not?
Yeah.
You've got a guy who was just flying with that character. And
you directed, you know, that scene with him and Chloe, right? I think it was
episode 5.
This was in the second series. It was last episode in the
last episode. The him and the baby.
Yeah,
the baby. Sorry. Yes.
See there, like that kind of set the tone for what could have came after. Like, you know what I mean? I thought, God, even, and we've kind of, with John and many of the actors over the last couple, the past how many episodes, we've kind of spoke about what High Times would be today if it was to return. And I think that there's the key point there, would be Rab Campbell and his daughter Chloe. Which, by the way, the daughter Chloe, Robin Ashcroft, actually contacted us. I asked Stephen this very question, and he's like, "I didn't keep tabs on the baby." But she's actually a really, really incredibly talented singer and musician.
Is she really?
Yes.
Oh, that's fantastic. Does she unbelievable.
Still snore. ask Stephen that one.
She's snoring. I know. I mean, that was an incredible, and yeah. It, you know, I saw the depth, not just Stephen. I mean, I think you know, the cast were on it throughout the whole show. But that was a great example of John's writing as well. You know, I mean, he for me, walking on, I realized, and it was why it was so special, was it was an anti-soap. I don't call it a sitcom because it very much used melodramatic tropes of soaps, almost like the Coen brothers do. I mean, just would give you something totally unexpected, sometimes incredibly blackly comedic, but always real, always true to the characters. I never felt it was it was trying to be clever with its tropes. It was always trying to be truthful to the characters it was portraying. But it would still do that in an unexpected way, in a really satisfying way, you know. And that was one of those scenes. I mean, that scene was incredible. To actually even weave, what a lot of people don't appreciate with a scene like that, the party scene, was you supposedly have all this disparate group of people that, you know, are connected, a bit like fungus under the ground, you know. And these are little fruits in the flats. But John had to weave, you know, all through that second series, the motivation for all these people to end up at this party. It wasn't just a, you know, you believed that they were all there for a reason. That just didn't happen in a couple of lines just before the party, you know. And then to throw them all in the mix, And then to then have a party after it was just, what a fucking day, you know.
So, I mean, that, I suppose I'm assuming it's not that common to film the final scene on the final day of a shoot. Or is it more common than I would think?
It's often talked about. It's often, a producer would be daft not to try and make that happen. It's a great way to go out, but it's not an easy thing to do. I mean, there's so many variables that dictate a schedule. I think that one, I don't know how they managed to do it. I suppose it was just such a tight thing that, you know, people weren't getting paid a fortune. So, you know, quite often it's because, well, if we have that actor for another week, they're going to cost us another 30 grand. You know, that was half the Heightens episode budget, you know. So it was, you know, I think it was maybe easier to do because of that in a way. But yeah, no, I wouldn't say it's normal. I really wouldn't, you know, quite unusual, actually.
High Times has always kind of, for us now, it kind of feels like, you know, when there's a band that had a couple of great songs back in the day, and then everybody starts to then listen to that music, but then wants there to be more, and everybody's still, you know, kicking about. It's there to be used there. I just think now would be a great time, especially now in 2020, to have something like High Times. Scottish TV needs it. You know, we don't have anything like Lemmy Show anymore. Yeah. You know, that's not a thing, neither Burniston. You know, I think to have something like High Times would be unbelievable. I think the biggest thing for us is trying to create awareness that this show exists and that people need to go and check it out, because when we watched it, obviously we're what, 15 years after, we're seeing it 15 years later, and to us the only thing that kind of felt outdated was, to quote Jordan, the mobile phones and Paul McCall's haircut.
Well, Paul McCall still looks like he's, you know, 15, 20 years now. I'm joking, Paul.
I've been speaking to Paul. Paul's looking really dapper these days. When he first came on the...
You weren't speaking to Paul.
Stephen. No, he first came on the show and he had the big beard and all that, right? And then I was speaking to him later and I was doing a Zoom call with him and he was all shaven and stuff. I was like, fucking hell.
Do you know what I mean? Must be a part.
Do you know how offended I was when I said that about his hair? Fucking hell.
Oh, he didn't take that well.
He's like, I fucking love that hair, shut it.
I remember, I think it was the second week I was filming with him, he'd come in and he'd got into some sort of fracas while he was out and about, and he had a cut to his face. And I had to, every scene, I mean, these are the thing, the pressures you're given. You can sort of see it in some shows, we try to hide it, but all the time I'd try and find another reason why he was only showing this side of his face. You know? So,
yeah. He
never talk about that in his interview.
No, he
did not. He seemed to have left that wee detail out, Justin.
Aye. So what was the ruckus?
I don't know, I wasn't there. I'm not even sure he knows.
Get fucking phone him.
He was telling us but about
these are the challenges you have as a director. You know?
God,
like, oh, for fuck's sake, right? Well, I can't bring you back next week. We're gonna have to shoot, you know.
God, and I take it you guys had an on-hand stylist there with John Comerford. We've been out to his salon, by the way. That have you been?
Have you?
Aye.
No. I've been past it. I've never been to it. No.
Ah, it's a really nice wee gaff, isn't it, Jordan? We actually recorded his episode in there with him.
Aye.
Big Tex.
What a character.
What was it? Brilliant.
Did you direct a lot of Tex?
I sort of came in and rounded up everyone's storyline, and Tex was very much in it. He was in the scene where he was sort of Cora was living with him. Cora's character was living with him, and he was going out with the woman who worked at the council who could get him a flat, you know, and he was playing the ladies in his usual sort of blind spotted way, you know. But yeah, no, and the syphilis storyline where she told him he had syphilis. And John was great. I can't remember if he did his own hair. He certainly didn't do my hair. You know, normally when I do a gig, I get somebody to cut my hair, but he didn't touch it.
God. I think with his character, there was still, again, and I said this as well, there's very few characters in High Times that you couldn't spin off to have their own wee show and go on another journey. Do you know what I mean? I think Tex was that, Rab and Jake, you could have had that. Tracy, when she goes away to the army, that would have been interesting, you know what I mean?
I'll be like Private Benjamin in Glasgow. Fucking yes.
I mean, Stephanie, she was great. I don't remember having a bad time there. I really don't. I don't just say that, you know, just to be nice. It really was. I mean, it was a hard job, but you know, as I say, I really the level of knowledge everyone had in their characters was just a joy to watch.
Yeah.
You know, everyone needs a bit of shaping somewhere on set, no matter how, because people need perspective. But that's all they sort of needed, you know. Mm-hmm. So it really did allow me to just relax and enjoy it and find my own groove in it, you know.
Would you say that was a credit to John Rooney's writing? Because when, I don't know if you've read the script Stoners, the Amsterdam script.
No, I was aware it was out there. No, I haven't.
We read that, right? John sent that to
Stephen's
us.
Stephen's told me about it, actually.
And you know what's the best thing about that is the way that John writes it, even the characters that we hadn't, because obviously it's set between the two series, right? The characters that were in it that we'd never seen on screen, you get it. Even like, we just get it. We get it. It tells a story in such a way that you can't even get the character. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's when we kind of saw that. But it was great for us reading that because we knew most of the characters. It was Rab and Jake. So we knew those characters and how you can hear them when you're reading it off the page. And for you need to read that, mate. Even now. Unbelievable. I was pissing myself reading it.
Just to give you a bit of perspective, there's a there's a Dutch porn baron in it. And his name's Yap Zai.
Oh dear!
You read it and you can't even believe it. You're like, fucking hell, John.
But that's it. And the answer to your question, I mean, it was in the writing. There's no doubt about it. There's a tipping point with writing. You know, you've got to have your plot. You've got to have your characters. You know, you've got to put them in the environment. But he was so driven by, again, character detail first and bury the rest of it into that, you know. And I think that's a really, you know, very great way of writing, because it really allows the audience to just lose themselves or be taken in by the reality of the characters, the depth of them, you know. Again, I think that's what the Coen brothers do really well, because they're very heightened and they look in at a world a bit more than John does. You feel more in there with John, but you know, even though it's so heightened, what they do a lot of the time, you're going with so much of the character detail that it's fine. The balance is right, you know, and that's what you got perfectly, I think, you know.
Aye. I mean, I think one of the things that's quite apparent when you're watching it is how well the dialogue flows and how natural it feels. Like when you watch a lot of soaps and stuff like that, it's all just forced line after line to move the story forward. Whereas the conversations that happen between characters and that, you can, I've had the same conversations, like especially conversations between Frank and Janet. I've had the same conversations with my missus to the point where I've lost 2 stone. Fucking dancer. It was Frank. Frank made me lose 2 stone.
And you rub cream into your genitals.
And you didn't ken she wanted one.
Actually, that was the first conversation. Eh?
it's funny. Jordan actually does a decent wee impression of Frank. You know, I'm going to ask.
Oh, I'm not doing it again.
Come on, mate.
I'm not a performing monkey.
Come on, that's not Frank. That's not Frank. Come on.
I know. I know. Right. Let's think. I didn't ken you wanted one.
And I tell you, that storyline with Molly, honestly, I mean, I think if I brought anything to that, I used to work as a chef and I definitely remember prodding that storyline a little bit. Not trying to make any claim in it at all, but I remember having a lot of fun with it. And it's a storyline I watch now and I cringe through it, I laugh through it. I mean, it's just like, no, don't do it. And you almost want, Cora to walk right in on Frank at that point and see him sort of with the food, but we resisted that partly because you can't see into the flat from the door. It would have felt too contrived to walk all the way around.
God.
But great, Tony was great in it. They all were.
Davey actually told us in his episode last week that he went from eating, what was it? He was eating a tin, meatballs at a tin, right? To then living with you and coming in. And he was like, and his reaction was this. He was like, he used to be a chef. And here's me eating my meatballs at a tin. And he's like, don't worry, I've made you some. Best years of his life.
I always used to make a little bit more. And then he brought his dog down. He was expecting me to feed his dog as well.
Oh, you left that bit out. See, people are very selective with details, I'm finding. I think we need to do this whole fucking series again. There's another 12 weeks to...
3 months in a house with Davey McKay in Leeds. It was a lot of fun. And his dog.
And his dog. Was that code word? No.
No.
Oh, Jesus.
No code.
He actually told us of the time where Martin Scorsese actually offered him a job on Gangs in New York, and you guys tried to help him get off where
that's right.
But it just couldn't be, yeah. And what would you have done in that scenario if Scorsese offered you a job on that movie? I mean, would you just jacked?
Well, I would say, are you fucking daft? I'm not an actor. But, you know, Davey was both at the time. I don't know. I mean, that's the thing about this game. I mean, you never know what's around the corner. Mm. You know, you take something. Whenever you make a choice to take something, you close the door on other things.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just unfortunate for Davey on that. At the same time, you know, my parents are aliens. You know, it was great for directing work, you know. But Davey's an actor first, I think, always has been, in a sense. So that was a sore one. I mean, I fell for him in that, you know.
Stephen told us something similar. Remember when he was, I think he was up for a role in Atlantis, but you were directing, and it ended up kind of went on and on. They didn't know if he was going to get it. Then he was having to do a play that he'd already done a round of, and he had to phone you and ask you, am I getting this or no? And you were like, I don't think so.
I know.
He's like, oh, fucking really take me out then. Aye.
I know. No, it's difficult. I mean, it's, you know, Steve's great to work with on many levels. And
One of the things we kind of quite get a head around, right, is the kind of actor that Stephen is, right, how it's not the case where you're seeing him every... And everything, do you know what I mean? Like you do with David Tennant and that. Stephen's just as good as anything, right? Yet, for some reason, like, is that a political thing within the industry? Is it, how is it that someone as talented as Stephen, and this isn't just to highlight him, but he is a different breed. You'll probably agree with that yourself, the kind of actor that he is.
Yeah, I think he's, I'm not going to. compliment him too much. He's incredibly talented, and you know, it's a bit about luck, it's a bit about timing, it's a bit about who you know. It's there's so many variables now out there dictating how things fall that it's not about thing. You know, he you could argue that he's just not necessarily an establishment person, but you know, what does that mean? I don't know. It's dumbfounded me at times. I think he's one of the top talents in Scotland as an actor, and I'll continue to do stuff with him if I can, you know. And I thought after Cry Me Laughter, certainly the performance, and in Hightower, but the performance he gives as a lead is incredibly powerful, and he was picked out for that with Cry Me Laughter, but it just sometimes doesn't open the doors you think it will. He'll continue to do.
Yeah.
You know, his time may come. You know, it's going to open up again. Who knows if you hang about long, it will open again at some point. You know,
I look at Bryan Cranston. I always reference him. I read.
That's not to say he's down and out.
No, of course not. Absolutely not. I just it's quite frustrating people in roles.
Yeah, I agree
that Stephen could do better. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And I often think about stories sometimes whenever I read a story or whatever, and I think who would be good in that, and so I think Stephen could do pretty much anything. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, he's very versatile.
I seen him in Save Me, and we talked about it briefly on the podcast, very fucking briefly. he's like, because I mentioned it, and he's like, "Mate, I never fucking told anybody I was in that."
Even when he was doing it, he told me, don't tell people it's me.
Telling us me.
I'll just act like it's no me.
Oh, man. It was funny. Like, when he showed up, I was like, oh, no, he's a pedo.
It's a difficult role to play for some, you know?
Yep. For some. For some. Imagine getting a role as a pedo and going, you know what, I can do this, no bother.
Second nature.
Well, to get, I mean, but that's when an actor's got at times, you know? It's like, you know, how do I bring truth to this? And it's, you know, it can be a difficult thing to process after you've done these things, you know. Mm-hmm. It's I certainly think with Cry Me Laughter as well, with Malcolm, you know, let's not forget the power of Malcolm's performance in that as well, you know, for Steve to play off that. And, you know, these things really happened to Malcolm to a point. That's what inspired the story, you know. And we talked about that beforehand. It's not Malcolm's story. It was inspired by events that happened to him. And we did an interview, Stephen and I, did an interview with Malcolm after the event as well. You know, that was really difficult for Malcolm to choose to do, to then actually do it, and then to finish doing it as a piece of art. Yet, you know, leaving parts of himself there, you know. So I think, I take my hat off to actors that are willing to, you know, take themselves in those really difficult shoes, you know.
Right. I mean, it's risky. I mean, the public can be quite stupid and hold roles like that against actors, you know what I mean? And, like, they can throw stuff at them in the street. People.
Well, the public, what was it, they attacked a paediatrician because they couldn't understand the meaning of the word, you know? You know, during some of the paedophile hunts or whatever, you know?
Right.
And you just think that, but that's what you're up against. I mean, it is difficult. You're also dealing, certainly, we're not here to talk about crime and laughter, but difficult subject matter that other people have experienced for real. And, you know, I remember after Crime and Laughter, somebody claimed that we'd stolen their story, and, you know, we just hadn't. But how do you rationalise that with somebody that's feeling burnt from it and, you know, probably experienced some of the things that happened in it, you know? And it's these are the tough things that...
That's the thing. But, I mean, with that subject matter, there's a good chance that a lot of people with these stories, I've got similar stories. You know, it's just a kind of tightrope that you need to walk when you're making something like that, I suppose.
And if you're not as plugged in as the people that have experienced it, it's an eye-opener, you know. I mean, it was a really refreshing thing for me. You know, Stephen and I did a lot of touring with Crime and Laughter after film festivals and that. The amount of people that were just really straight and open with me about things they'd experienced, and they thought the film was really positive, men, etc., you know. But there's also people that really didn't like what I did at all, you know. And, you know, actors have to deal with that as well, as you say, you know. The people start to sort of blur the lines between fiction and reality, which, you know, if I'm honest, is what I was doing as a writer, director in that film as well, you know.
I suppose it's a good thing when you actually blur the lines, because that's what you want, really, isn't it? It's something real.
Yeah.
If you're playing a bad guy, you want somebody to come up to you in the street and be like, how could you kill him? It's like, that's my job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It just means people are invested, and when people are invested in something... Do you know what I mean?
I mean, Crime Will After, I'd ordered that. I got it off Amazon years and years ago now. I think it was after I'd first seen The Wee Man.
Good on you.
And I bought it. Uh-huh. It took about 2 weeks to come. I think it was a seller through Amazon sort of thing. It wasn't the one that they had on tap.
Yeah.
So it took a while to come, and I watched it, and I mean, it's really funny at bits as well. It's really a really dark sense of humour in it, which, like, Stephen plays that really well. Been playing the stand-up comedian, fuck, I mean, nerve-wracking can't be the word, I'd imagine, to do something like that. Because he did it, basically.
Well,
just went up
itself,
and did it.
He went and put himself out in the circuit to bring authenticity to that part, because I think quite often films with stand-up comedians, if they don't stand up to the truth in a sense, you know, and he was meant to be a decent stand up, you know. You know, you just lose your audience. There's just a lack of truth all around kicking about with it. So we tried to really find that environment, that precinct that was really authentic, and his voice in it was authentic. And, you know, again, it's still quite a raw film in many respects, but, you know, it was another sort of stepping stone to, you know, I suppose, experiencing, you know, the bigger form, you know, jumping into a feature film like that was what we were ready to go. And it was a great team to do it. It was just, we shot that in 18 days, you know.
Wow.
I mean, it was a ridiculously tight schedule. But it was, it was what I was saying before, it was our opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the window that opened up for me as a director, writer, and for other people at that time. And what are you going to do? Say no?
Yeah,
I know.
You know, yeah. Obviously you're on the line if it's a pile of shite, you know, but thankfully crime will after.
So no, you did all right with that one. Like, it was, if I do say so myself.
that was developed purely by with improvisation workshops. I mean, that was me really fully going to improvisation as a device to write a story. You know, Malcolm, Stephen, and I, you know, as a core cast, there was others that obviously joined it, but we basically workshopped that for about 6 weeks, and then went away and wrote the script. Stephen will say I wrote down the script, but, you know, that's the tussle you have. But no, I mean, we developed that in rooms, and then, you know, went through the filter process, and then even my, you know, not even my own script, but you know, my own script is also a leaping off point. I don't treat it any differently. Mm-hmm. I pass it over to myself as a director. I try not to blur mm-hmm. that line. And again, I knew what I did know I had in front of me. And you know, High Times was that connection. Mm-hmm. Was I had two fucking cracking actors who were at the top of their game and wanted to run with these characters in mm-hmm. a similar way that I saw in High Times. You know, it inspired me that way. And the blackness, the black tone of it, it's not John's voice, but, you know, there's definitely that black comedy that runs through that I think is definitely inspired by, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Malcolm showed up in High Times as well. He was the cop that kind of consoled John Morrison. Eddie, there we go. I keep
that's right.
I fucking hell, Eddie. Murder to remember the character name sometimes.
I think that's a lovely scene, actually. Again, that's John doing the unexpected with it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah,
you've
absolutely.
Got this absolute, you know, really aggressive young cop. You know, that we can all do if we, you know, and then this older guy who just surprises you with his mm-hmm. wisdom and his personal connection, and, you know, get this masculinity kicking about, John ready to punch fucker, you know. It's just a really moving wee scene, you know.
Yeah, I mean, what's good about Malcolm is that, I mean, obviously, in that wee role that he had, I mean, it was only a couple of minutes screen time, if that. But in that wee role, you think he's perfect for that because he looks like a wee hardened cop, but he's got a heart.
Aye.
And it was ripping at him and that. And
it was, aye.
He's the kind of, what you get from that scene is that he's the kind of guy that on the weekends, on the weekdays or that, is out at clubs ripping folk up and handcuffing them. But on the weekdays, he's taking his granddaughters for ice cream, right? they didn't see that aye. Side. That's definitely what you get for him.
I just want to know what clubs you go to during the week.
Hey, this is my club.
If it's open on a Tuesday afternoon, it's fucking dirty.
It's called soft play.
Let's not forget Malcolm does a star turn in what is it, the last scene as well, second last scene, when they're raiding Jake's flat.
Oh, of course, aye.
Malcolm has a guest appearance there as well, so he did get a second wage. Yeah, it wasn't that hard done by.
Aye. There was actually, and this was in the second series, there was someone actually contacted me on Twitter and said that his friend, who was in the show, was a renowned shagger. He was one of the guys that came for weed at the door. Do you? You know what I'm talking about? Aye?
Are you talking about Finlay?
I think so. Aye. He said that he was like, the guy was like, here, Google him. He's a renowned worldwide shagger. I was like, what? He's like, aye.
He said that.
Oh, I'm gonna get it up on Twitter. There was a fella on Twitter basically said that he was really looking forward to David Mackay's episode. But aside from that, were we aware that one of the extras that came on to buy weed from Rab and Jake was a world renowned shagger? And it was Sid Fishies. Do you know who Sid Fishes is? No.
No.
Someone called Sid. He said, I'll read it.
Sid.
Yeah, Sid said, see in the second series, two guys come to Rab's door for weed. The one with a bandana on is his pal of mine and Davies, Mick Burns.
Oh, right. I'm getting confused. You know what? I thought you were taking the piss out of me there because I appear in an episode.
Right.
I'm leaving the flat. And that's why I said Finlay.
Right.
It's just a moment. We wanted a bit of movement at the door and I got dressed up as a goth. I'll sometimes do a little sort of walk-on part, you know. And I left the flat and Rab goes, cheers, Finlay. And as I'm walking away, he does that.
Right.
And I thought that's what you were referring to. So, no, I'm not the top shagger. who's band lead from Rab.
You can be second. You can be second.
I was going to correct you. No, that's what I thought. I thought that's what you were referring to. And somebody was taking the piss.
Well, I'm glad we've got that one out there as well.
Yeah, I have no idea who the fuck you're on about. You know what? That must have been Davies' episodes.
Probably, because that guy said Fishies was a friend of Davies.
Yeah, I'm disappointed. You've not brought up Finlay. You
know, right.
I think it's episode four. The start of a new day, and I'm just leaving. Anyway, John never wrote it. I improvised it.
So tell us about Finlay.
just another stoner friend of Rab's, really. Who likes it.
Aye.
A bit of goth. That was as deep as it got.
Davey actually, his voice was in the scene where Paul's singing through the letterbox to John Morrison, right? As his voice is on the telly.
Stooky.
Aye. That's right.
That's right. We could use Stooky because STV didn't have to pay for it. It was part of the STV back catalogue. No doubt Davey Mackay got a repeat fee.
Nice. I found it really funny because I specifically remember, right, that scene and watching it, because we've watched the full series like continuously, like, so I could pretty much name everything that happens in it, right? And I do remember when it got to that point, I was like, the fuck is he watching, man? I just remember going, what the fuck is that?
Yeah, that was your choice when we were in the edit. No, it wasn't in the edit. We couldn't afford green screen. We basically needed pre-cleared footage for any TV stuff. So if you look at it, it's all old STV stuff. You know, certainly when or it's made up, you know.
What about the part?
It's the one thing I felt like, well, that disappointed me a little bit was, I mean, the original music that we had in it isn't, I mean, the theme tune's the same, but they obviously changed all the music in it for streaming because they didn't have the clear for it. So it's pretty shit music in a lot of it, certainly from what I saw. They've certainly changed
David
all
the said
stuff
the same thing.
At the time. Which does play with the rhythm that you've created in the editing stuff to a certain extent, but maybe I'm just see it more than others, you know?
I mean, you kept Paul McCall's music in it, so that's
a
point of...
Paul's cheap.
Paul's cheap. I'm sure they did give him like a Zippo lighter and a chippy for his troubles.
A haircut voucher.
No, that was the Comerford special. That was not sweet. I think he did say in his episode that they bought him a guitar because he basically said after the first series he was skint. So he had to sell his guitar, right? And then when they brought him back, they were like, right, we're going to get you to do your music again. And he's like, I've not got a guitar. So they're like, right, so if we buy you this guitar, eekies.
Fucking ridiculous, isn't
it? It was a very low-budget show.
Aye. I mean, see, it's a low-budget show, and you're saying that the budget's like, what was it, 50 grand an episode, maybe 60. Like, to us guys that earn not a lot of money a year doing jobs that we fucking love, in inverted commas, that sounds like a lot of money. But,
well, yeah, but
obviously it's not.
That was a job we love for not a lot of money. I mean, that 50 grand, when you've got 20 actors, and you know, you got location. I mean, it's just nothing. I mean, it really is for drama, it's as low as you can probably go for half an hour. I mean, it's, you know, I was getting more for a 10-minute short film. I was getting double that doing a tartan short. you know, a few years before that. You know, I mean, it really, it's nothing. And that's what I mean. We had to be incredibly fleet of foot and creative in the moment to pull it off in that sense, you know, and yeah. just shoot it really efficiently.
What kind of challenges did you find with it just because of the micro budget?
You know, you can't afford. I think one of the biggest challenges, budget in a way, it was the environment. I mean, you really are. There's no sets there. It's a condemned block of flats with a few people living in it. And if you're shooting in a room, where does everyone go? You know what I mean? It's like, well, we're in a flat, you know. Well, everyone's crammed about this. I mean, it's really quite a claustrophobic and place to work in. You've got lights going down, just heats up really quickly, you know. You don't have money to buy you any luxuries, I suppose, is what I'm saying there, you know. We really were sort of just moving from flat to flat, trying to get it as efficiently as possible. I'm not sure how much help money would have had. In a way, it might have given you more time to shoot it and maybe some toys to play about with, where you could put rigs outside the windows and stuff, you know, but it might have spoiled the energy of it. I mean, part of the low budget was part of the energy of it, I think, you know, and partly why it feels still very connected to Blackout, the original short that inspired it. But then again, there was a series recently set in a block in London, wasn't there? And that was much more glossy, and High Times just wouldn't have worked glossy.
No.
It feels a bit punk, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
If you were to bring High Times back, do you think you would approach it that very same way today?
I don't think I could, because I'm not Justin of 20 years ago. I just couldn't, you know.
Would you make a conscious attempt at it, do you think, just to kind of keep that?
I think I would hopefully do it better, you know. but who knows? I mean, it's, you know... you know, the experience you get, I suppose, it's not that you don't use instinct anymore, but you know, it's not as prevalent a lot of the time, because experience sort of kicks in. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know what I'd do with it. I mean, how is John writing another show?
No, I mean, we spoke to John, and he said to us that, you know, if the stars aligned, he says he's always felt that he had more High Times on him. He still feels he's got more High Times on him. The only issue,
of course, massively.
He had a bit of a sour taste in his mouth after the way it was treated and how the way he was treated, kind of thing. But he says, you know,
absolutely.
He says, today, if there was a budget, right, and if everything was in place and the ability to make it happen would happen, he 100% would do it. And he thinks that he knows how all the characters would go. And he said the thing as well about John is he's one of those guys that, like, he said he can sit at a computer and just write all day. You know, someone like me, if I was a writer, I can't stay in the same place for too long. I use the word different. He's a different breed. And I think that's why his writing is so unique, because he's just that kind of unique writer. And I think to have that today, I think that'd be amazing. I think that's what's missing. And to have after 2020, you know what I mean?
Yes, yeah.
I think that would be phenomenal. So, you know,
he is an out-and-out writer.
It's a shame that we've not seen more of his work throughout the last 10, 15 years. Do you know what I mean? It's a disservice to, like,
that's what you're saying about what you were saying about Stephen before, though, and why you don't see, you know, you know, and absolutely the same with John. And again, that's an example of it. You know, I think for one, that show should have ran. I think, you know, it's partly you're dealing with the merry-go-round of execs at these companies at times, you know. It's like, well, if they didn't come up with the idea, they won't, you know, that can be pushed aside. We'll do our own thing. And it took a couple of years for that to go out. I also think, you know, BBC Scotland, you know, that it's not incumbent upon them to sort of take a show, but they should have snapped that up. That was, you know, we've got River City, but you had a show there that was absolutely, you know, running beautifully, you know. I know it's an anti-soap, so it maybe didn't fit what they were trying to do, but you think, why didn't the BBC harness that talent at least, you know? But then again, John did get some really cool commissions with some big companies. I just, again, it just didn't quite happen at that time for him. And it's who knows why, you know, it's certainly not lack of talent.
No, for sure.
He is an out and out writer and a brilliant one at that. And you know, I will forever be thankful of having worked on that show, you know. Yeah.
Well, the amazing thing is, like, and I've said this to everybody that we spoke to, it's 2020 and we live in a world now where you don't necessarily need the big companies to commission stuff. Like, there's a thing called Just Given, Patreon. There's ways that if an audience is already there and wants to see more of it, then it can be crowdfunded. Do you know what I mean? We put the right people in the right place, crowdfund it, and who's to say that it doesn't need, you know, that. I think that the starting point to kind of revive High Times would be to get the original series on a streaming network, something like Netflix or Amazon Prime, something like that.
You're dealing with IP there and commercial companies that are just really reluctant to, and if they don't need to. I think also the other thing that I think is very difficult for Joe Public to comprehend is, you're absolutely right, you can put in the crowdfunding, but, you know, producers are there for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, you need somebody, you know, I mean, it's a Carlin. I don't know if you spoke to Carlin, but it's, maybe she would do it, you know. But you really need somebody that's willing to go out on a limb to start with, to wrangle all that. And it's a lot of work and energy, you know, and then to then fulfill that promise that you've made to all these people. And, that, you know, it's, you know, people go insane in this game for very good reason. And a producer is a hidden person with a lot of strings behind the scenes, you know.
Yeah.
And John is a fantastic writer, but he's not a producer. So to say to John, crowdfund it, go and do it. I mean, you know, it's like, where do you start? You know, if you haven't got that skill set. Yeah. Maybe he has got that skill set. Maybe that's what he's secretly doing that you're not telling me. But
no. I mean, we did speak to Carolyn. We spoke to everybody, and everybody so far has said, you know, if it was a possibility, they'd jump at it. Carolyn as well. Yeah. She actually gave us a few contacts in regards to speaking to people and TV and all that about how to kind of go about it. We have a lot of energy as two budding podcasters that try to dip try to kind of move our way through.
Are you filmmakers as well?
We're not filmmakers in a sense that we've made any films, but we
that's the end of the fucking sentence, isn't it?
But we are in the middle of writing stuff. We do conventions where we show up that day with our camera equipment, our audio equipment, and we write on the spot. We highlight stuff. We're starting from the absolute trenches and taking every single piece of advice and every single piece of experience and treating that as our goal to get to a point one day where we're like, right, we can actually try this and try and do something special. And
I'm writing a short film tonight.
We've got 4K cameras, we've got everything, audio, mics, everything. We have literally everything that a film crew need, from guys that edit, animate, music, everything. It's just a case of putting it to something now. And that's kind of, you know,
I think that is it. You can do it now. I mean, you've always been able to do it to a certain extent. Since it's why I first started getting into the proliferation of video equipment in the late 80s, early 90s. I just started hiring VHS video camera and did stop frame animation of joints rolling themselves and stuff, you know. And it was that's your sort of early films that you hope nobody ever sees, you know. But but everyone leads to the next film. But no, it is about starting from scratch and just building up the experience, you know. And if you're lucky, you keep going. But you know, I've seen many a talented person disappear in this game because, as I say, it's not just down to the talent. There's so many other factors.
I mean, this situation,
variables at play. You know,
situation now with COVID is a nightmare for everybody as well. I mean, it's the way I feel the news. I think I feel, and Kev probably feels as well, creatively constipated. You know, I mean, we're dying to put something out, and it's stuck because all this shite.
We're making the official documentary for you've seen the movie Lost Boys. Right. So the song from that, Cry Little Sister, is written by a guy called G. Tom Mack. He's wrote songs for Kiss.
Right. Wow.
He wrote Roger Daltrey's album, Eminem, all that. Well, we're actually doing his documentary, his official documentary, and we've already had him over to Scotland, filmed with him, and we were due to go over to to LA and film with some really famous people, film more of his life and stuff. But COVID fucking it's put a halt to it. So we're kind of creatively trying to see.
Stuck with,
yeah,
with High Times people.
Oh, no, absolutely not. That do you know what? That's a thing of beauty. That's the only thing that we can kind of thank for COVID for, right?
Fucking waste of time, eh?
Absolutely not. No, absolutely not.
I was meant to start an Outlander in May, and that just, I could see it closing down week to week, and you know, hopefully going to start that again in January. But yeah, no, it's been brutal on many respects. I mean, I've been fortunate in as much for me, I've just put my head into some writing and managed to get a bit of funding there and some traction on a project, which was great. Right. But you know, without that, it really would have been an incredibly lean year. But you know, I don't sit there expecting the world to happen. You know, it's sometimes it is a feast and famine. You know,
yeah, for sure.
But yeah, no, good on you for doing it. It's great. It's great this, you know, these things have life. You know, and life beyond as well. You know, as I say, my parents are aliens. It was last week somebody came up to me and says, I just wanted to say that was an amazing show. Thank you very much. And I'm like, fuck's sake.
It was. You know? It was good to always come home and have that to look forward to. You know
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah,
and it felt really like a family. You felt.
Yeah.
You
know, when you watched it.
Josh and Mel. Mel, man, she was such a. She was always grumpy.
Yeah. Very cleverly. Yeah, she was very cleverly written. And I realise now, writers on it, one of the writers from Davey and Maggie are. Was Jess Armstrong, who writes the Brian Cox Succession.
Ah, right.
That's his show. So, you know, he's went on and done. Andy Watts, the creator of it, I don't know what happened to Andy. He probably was just made an absolute fortune out of being the creator of 10 series of it, you know. It was sold around the world 100 million times.
Wow.
But, Jess Armstrong was... Yeah, I think that was his first TV gig, actually. You know that?
Yeah, wow.
Just goes you know, to show, which is quite amazing. Yeah.
I wonder if he done podcasting first.
Yeah, I wonder. Hey, we all got to start somewhere.
Exactly.
As a chef, as I say, you know.
Hey, for sure. Well, sorry, because when we make the money from the G Tom Mac documentary, we're just going to pile it into the new series of High Times. We'll just pass it to you and go, right, go do your thing. Step away and watch it. You can use all our equipment and everything. We'll just kind of, as long as we get to show up and kind of watch it going on, eh?
I said that.
I mean, I can sort of run with Finlay as a character then.
Hey, we're bringing that, man.
Game on storylines.
Finlay the Mad Shagger.
Or not, as the case may be.
Hi, he's a phony. Phony Shagger.
He's an impotent goth.
Oh, man, that'd be class. That'd be bloody brilliant.
It's something it's a program that's going to stick with us for a long time. Mm-hmm. And like I said, everybody we've spoken to that's been involved basically said the same thing. It was a great part of their journey as well. And obviously, we need to say thanks to you for your input as well.
Absolutely.
And it's.
Not at all. Thanks really, for asking me.
Really want to see more of it. So keep it in mind. Don't forget anything.
I won't.
So,
thanks. I will hopefully meet up with you sometime for real.
Hey, absolutely. We'll get a beer on the go and kind of chat about the
project.
Absolutely. For sure.
Good.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Justin. Thanks for giving us your time. I think we've taken more of your time than what we were meant to.
But, you know, you can edit it down. Where can I listen to them, actually? I don't even, you know, genuinely, I've not heard any of these.
You can find it Spotify, Apple, iTunes, YouTube.
Send me a link.
Aye, of course, we'll send you all the links.
Send me a link, will you?
Aye, you can. Aye. It's from everybody. Everybody from A to B, right to yourself, being the final one. A lot of them have all got really good and funny stories. Yourself's mentioned in it. Like, we already knew everybody before we got to speak to them because of all the stories we'd heard. So we formed these opinions, you know. Really?
It's
a lasting legacy. It's a great testament to just a shame that it ended when.
Well,
that's what happens.
You never know what's around the corner, eh? You never know what's around the corner.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Thanks again, Justin.
Cheers. Thank you.
Cheers. That's it, guys. That's it. The High Times series has come to an end. as always, everybody from the High Times has always given us a lot to laugh about, nothing to cry about. In fact, the fact that it's no longer a thing makes you want to cry. But that's why we've got to help change that in the future. That's it, man. That's it. This was something we looked forward to, poured our heart and soul into, and it's over. How do you feel, Jordan?
We need to find something else. We need to try and top it. Even if we can't top it, we need to try and get close.
Right, my parents are aliens. We'll get...
just get everybody for that. Basically the same folk again.
Do you know what? I think we've got something in the pipeline which is going to be a nice wee entree. Is that what they call it? An entree?
An entree is a main course.
No, then. It's a dessert. Fuck the analogy, man. Get all that stuff away. Yeah. So moving forward now, it's been a while since you guys have heard like a normal Jibber Jabber podcast, because all we've done now is the High Time series for the last 12 weeks. So that's been some time we've been doing that. And we wanted to put all our focus and all our energy into that. So that's why we kind of held back on releasing just normal Jibber Jabber podcast episodes. Anyways, the time has come for us to take the next step. You will still be able to listen to our show audibly through everywhere. Remember, we're on Apple Podcasts, we're on Spotify, you can find us on Google Podcasts, you can find us on Amazon, everywhere that does podcasts, you'll find our show there. But for those people, and there's been many of you that have asked us over the years, you know, why are you not on YouTube? We're on YouTube, you just can listen to us on YouTube, but as of next week, our show will be
it will be
our show.
Yeah, fucking clunge.
Our show will be visually available for all of you on YouTube, so you'll be able to look at us talking. We're going to have a wee bit of a setup which makes it a little bit immersive, and you'll be able to see us talk shit, laugh. We've got a few things coming up. We're coming up with there's one called the topic of the week, where we'll kind of take 5 minutes to discuss what's been going on that week, see if we can get some humor in it. But J-Mac, my great idea that you aptly named, tell them what one of the things that we're going to be doing on the new episodes.
It's going to be called Movie Mouthfuls, and basically we're going to have to give a 30 second review of a movie that we've watched recently with a mouth full of fucking something.
Not cock.
Speak for yourself. I like that.
What? It's going to be like something like a brownie or something like that. Something that's really messy. And we're going to...
You can't say brownie after cock and no laugh.
This took our time. We're going to be doing movie mouthfuls, which is that's the intro for it, right? And now movie mouthfuls. Right. We're basically eat like some sort of cake and try and review something you've watched recently within like 30 seconds. We've done this as a tester. I done it with a Rocky Road before we started hitting the record, and both of us couldn't breathe. So it's something we're looking forward to, so that you'll be able to see us do this. You'll also be able to hear our reactions. As always, our show will be available on MP3. Like it always is, but you can take the extra step and come and subscribe to our YouTube for when this first episode goes out. You can find us at Jibber Jabber Podcast on YouTube. Everywhere that you go, just check out Jibber Jabber Podcast. You'll find it. Go to our website, www.jibberjabberpodcast.com, and you'll get all the links to everywhere that we are, and you'll be able to kind of see what we're doing, and it's going to be pretty class. Jordan, you're also doing a new thing. Jordan's leaving the podcast. No, he's not leaving, but he's doing something on the side, I suppose. Tell him a little bit about what you've got coming up.
Yeah, it's a wee kind of side project. That's not going to take anything away from this, so nobody panic.
Next week, I'll be like, Jordan's no ears. I'm joined today by Rab.
If that happens, it's only because you fucking sacked me.
Right.
It's going to be called Flick and Tipple, which sounds a lot dirtier than it actually is. Okay. Flick and Tipple. So basically, it's myself and a good friend of mine are going to be sitting down.
What's his name?
His name is David.
Oh, no, you need David Mack.
Big D Mack.
D Mack.
D Cup. D Cup. D Mack and D Cup.
Oh, nice.
Up until recently, I had a D Cup. So yeah, myself and David, we're going to sit down. It might not be every week, it might be every couple of weeks, maybe once a month. We're going to sit down and we're going to review an alcoholic beverage of some kind, whether it's a craft beer, craft cider, a whiskey, a gin, anything like that. We don't care what it is, as long as it's got fucking booze in it, right? We're going to sit down, we're going to give our opinions on that, and then we're going to watch a movie and basically give our opinion on that. The key to this podcast is that we should be getting drunk throughout the movie. So what you get is a sober drink review and a pished film review. So I think it could catch on. I think you'll enjoy it. And like I said, it's going to be called Flick and Tipple.
Starring that guy doing
J-Mac and D-Cup.
God dang. All right, so guys, go and check out Jordan's new venture. And if you wonder why he never came back to Jibber Jabber, that's why.
Because he was pished.
So we've got a lot of cool stuff on the horizon. We've got our fingers in many pies, no double entendres there. So just keep an eye on what we're up to. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, MySpace.
MySpace again. Do you know what's funny? It's not like we've even been around that long to have ever had a MySpace. Yeah, every time. MySpace. In fact, while we're at it, fucking check us out on Bebo and Friends Reunited. I batter into all that.
We're everywhere, man. We're everywhere. Just check us out. If you can give us a review.
Also available on MSN Messenger. ASL.
ASL. Oh, man. I'll see you on Teen Chat. If you guys...
I'm still in that.
If you guys like our episodes, you like our podcast, you want to hear stuff, you got any ideas that you think we should pursue, you know, guys, I love this show. Any chance you get someone on for that, drop us a wee line. Nothing's off the table. If anybody else would like to join the Jibber Jabber podcast when J-Mac leaves, just send your CV to jibberjabberscotland at gmail.com.
Sorry, let me just make one thing clear.
I did not have sexual relations with that lady. 3 weeks later, I had sexual relations.
I'm not fucking leaving!
So there you have it, guys. He's not leaving, so you'll see.
He's leaving!
You'll see him and myself over on YouTube, where our show will launch next week. It's going to be a fucking laugh. Go ahead and check out there. Thanks again to everybody that checked out this High Time series. It's been an absolute bloody pleasure for us. It's something that we never thought we'd ever be able to do, and it was made possible with the help of the fucking genius of Stephen McCall. So guys, go and check out all their cool stuff. There's links in every description of everybody that what they're up to now and where you can find them. They're a talented bunch, and we hope to see more for them in the future. Hope to see more High Times in the future. For this full High Time series, I have been Kevin Wells. J-Mac, who you've been?
I've been me, I suppose. It's been a pleasure. I've been me. He's been him. We'll see you next time, and I will still be here because I ain't fucking leaving!
See you guys next week on YouTube, guys.
Bye! Why the happy ever afters never seem to last? I need